IAEA chief, Rafael Grossi, has arrived in Tehran on an official visit. Israeli fighter jets conduct fresh airstrikes in the Gaza Strip, targeting several areas in the south of the besieged Palestinian territory. And at least three rockets land near Erbil International Airport in northern Iraq, where U.S. forces are stationed. Hello and welcome to your World News, coming to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, an informed source stressed there will be no change in the International Atomic Energy Agency's access to its cameras at Iran's nuclear sites. This comes as the IAEA chief, Rafael Grossi, has arrived in Tehran on an official visit. The source dismissed Western media reports that Iran has agreed to grant the agency access to its cameras in the country's nuclear sites. The source stressed that a talks with Grossi will only include repair and maintenance of some of the IAEA's monitoring equipment. Iran restricted the agency's access to the cameras as part of its commitment cuts under the 2015 nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. Tehran says the move is in response to the other signatories' failure to uphold their ends of the deal. Meanwhile, JCPOA revival talks in Vienna appear to have stalled. Homolesky says the outcome of the IAEA chief's visit to Tehran can have an impact on the upcoming session of the agency's Board of Governors.
Mr. Grossi has said that he wants to know whether Iran is going to continue recording the data, whether it is going to indeed go ahead with a decision that was announced earlier that it would delete the information, whether the agency can actually have this continuity of knowledge when it comes to the activities in Iran. And if the information from this source turns out to be correct, then that is not what the agency is going to get, and we'll have to see how that is going to affect the IAEA Board of Governors session that's expected to start on Monday. And another issue, of course, that Mr. Grossi would probably discuss with Iran in his visit would be his complaints concerning questions about uranium traces found in undeclared locations in Iran. Iran has said, however, that it has been cooperating with the agency on these matters that concern Iran's past nuclear activities, so it doesn't concern any current obligation that Iran has under the Comprehensive Safeguards Agreement. So overall, if despite all that we're hearing, if the outcome of Mr. Grossi's visit to Tehran is seen as positive and is seen as a sign that the agency and Iran are continuing what can be termed as a constructive form of cooperation, maybe that will have a positive impact on the IAEA Board of Governors session as well.
Political commentator Mike Harris says the double standards that Iran is being subjected to regarding its nuclear program are outright hypocrisy.
The expectation, the double standard that Iran is being held to compared to neighboring countries in the region like Israel, who has a very vigorous and active nuclear program, but yet no one acknowledges it because they keep it secret. This is outright hypocrisy here. And I think that we need to push for not just a nuclear-free Middle East, but for a nuclear-free planet, nuclear-free globe. But as I stated, the double standard that Iran is held to is not reasonable. And I think the Iranian government, the Iranian people have a right to refuse this, because there are certain national security interests that every country has, and a nuclear weapons program, the only reason to have a nuclear weapons program is to keep yourself from being invaded by other aggressor countries. It's not a very good weapon all in all, but it's such a devastating weapon that no one's going to want to interfere with your internal affairs if you're a nuclear power. So I think that Iran needs to stand their ground, and I think that they need to say, we'll do what the rest of the world does regarding their nuclear weapons programs. And so the U.S., Russia, France, Great Britain, Israel, they've all set a standard about what is in their national interest. And I think Iran, as a sovereign nation, has the exact same right to do the exact same thing.
Israel has carried out fresh airstrikes in the Gaza Strip, targeting several areas in the south of the besieged Palestinian territory. The regime's warplanes fired at least six missiles at Rafah, southern Gaza. Israeli military claims they targeted positions belonging to the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas. Israel says the airstrikes came in response to rockets and incendiary balloons from the coastal sliver. No casualties or material damage have been reported so far. Three rockets have hit near U.S. forces stationed at Erbil International Airport in northern Iraq. A statement by the Kurdish counterterrorism force said the attack was carried out using explosive-laden drones. There were no immediate reports of damage or casualties. Witnesses say they heard at least six explosions in the area. This is the latest in a series of attacks on American forces in the Arab country. The airport in the capital of the semi-autonomous Kurdish region has been attacked several times in the past year. Political commentator Zafar Bangesh says repeated attacks on U.S. forces on the Iraqi soil indicates that they are not welcome in the region.
American presence is not welcome in the region. People all across the region, whether it's in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, and we saw the most recent example in Afghanistan, where America and its NATO allies were driven out of the country after a 20-year war. It is absolutely certain that America's malign influence is resented by the people of the region because it has brought nothing but death and destruction to millions of people in that region. And so it's not surprising that there have been repeated attacks in Erbil and other places. In fact, a number of political parties in Iraq have repeatedly called for withdrawing all American forces from Iraq. And so this is something that we witness. It is now becoming much clearer in the sense that people are now speaking out forcefully, and we see the consequence that there are attacks on American forces to drive them out of the region.
In Turkey, thousands of people have held a demonstration in Istanbul against COVID-19 vaccinations and the government's coronavirus restrictions. Protesters say the new measures violate their rights and are against international laws. On Monday, the government began requiring proof of vaccination or a negative COVID test for all users of intercity planes, buses, and trains, as well as for those attending large events such as concerts. All unvaccinated school employees are required to take a PCR test twice per week. Masks and social distancing are required in public places. Nearly 65% of Turks have received two vaccine shots. Still, about 23,000 new cases on average are reported on a daily basis. Clashes have erupted between Greek police and anti-COVID-19 vaccination protesters in the northern city of Thessaloniki. Police fired tear gas and water cannons to disperse the crowd. Authorities say about 1,000 protesters tried to reach the venue where Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis was delivering his annual economic policy speech. Protests against the country's vaccination program started in July after the government announced mandatory jobs for health workers and nursing home staff. Nearly 6,000 health workers have been suspended for missing a deadline to get at least partially vaccinated. The U.S. president has issued a vaccine mandate which would apply to about two-thirds of all American employees. The decision has drawn criticism from senior Republicans who are threatening to sue the Democratic administration. In the meantime, the fate of the U.S. economy is hanging in the balance.
The coronavirus pandemic has not only cost countless lives, but has hit the world economy hard. The United States, which has the world's biggest economy, hasn't been an exception. The U.S. is the world's worst-hit nation by the pandemic. Under former President Donald Trump, the country launched a program called Operation Warp Speed to facilitate and accelerate the production and distribution of COVID-19 vaccines. U.S. pharmaceutical companies developed several vaccines and rolled them out to the country's population. Trump's successor, Joe Biden's administration, set a target of vaccinating 70% of the country's population, at least partially, by the 4th of July. However, the country met the target a month later, despite generous incentives given to Americans.
So at least 40% of the U.S. population is a victim of a lot of silly conspiracy theories about the vaccine and are adamant about not taking the vaccine. It's a big problem in the U.S. that's been stoked by social media and QAnon and, you know, career right-wing politicians who are manipulating it all for their personal gain. So the U.S. Is confronting with this real problem.
The vaccination program proved effective at bringing down the daily COVID cases and deaths, but up to a certain point. The highly infectious Delta variant of the coronavirus sent a new wave of cases and fatalities across the world. Scrambling to contain the spiraling outbreak, President Biden announced new mandatory vaccination plans on Thursday.
I will sign an executive order that will now require all executive branch federal employees to be vaccinated. All. And I've signed another executive order that will require federal contractors to do the same. If you want to work with the federal government and do business with us, get vaccinated.
But in addition to saving lives, the U.S. government is aiming at saving the economy, too.
Well, it certainly would help because we have a problem going on of a lot of workers not wanting to go back to work now that the COVID Delta variant is accelerating in a lot of places in the country. That was obvious in the last month's job report.
The mandatory vaccination program has triggered a backlash from American conservatives.
The U.S. government's mask mandate proved to be a divisive topic among Americans, with conservatives voicing the strongest opposition to it. The same continues with COVID-19 vaccines, as just over 50% of the country's population is currently fully inoculated, which is far below the previous projections. The other point of disagreement between the two political camps has been President Biden's most recent stimulus plan, which is being criticized as harmful to the economy in the long run.
Hours after the Democratic U.S. president announced a coronavirus vaccine mandate for federal workers, Republicans lambasted the decision, suggesting that it's unconstitutional. Figures, including Republican National Committee Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel, threatened to take legal action against the Biden administration. A majority of the critics are questioning the administration's authority to declare such a mandate. Back in March, the Democrats in the U.S. Congress passed a bill for a $1.9 trillion coronavirus stimulus package without a single vote from Republican lawmakers. The plan was intended to send direct payments of up to $1,400 per person to the majority of American households, extend a $300 per week unemployment insurance supplement, and put funds into vaccine distribution. The Republicans argued that the package was superfluous as the economy was reopening anyway. They believed the economy would suffer down the road, considering how big a figure the bill earmarked.
Well, you know, that's a false argument. What the Republicans are really about is that they don't want to spend on these stimulus programs, because if the stimulus programs spending amounts to significant fiscal stimulus, then they'll have to raise taxes on corporations and investors, which means they'll have to reduce some of the generous Trump tax cuts of 2017. That gave $4.5 trillion in tax cuts to corporations and wealthy individuals and investors. They would have to raise taxes, and that's really what it's about. They don't want to raise those taxes. They don't want to take away Trump tax cuts if they got to have to spend a lot on social programs.
With the United States COVID-19 figures rising in recent weeks, economic indicators are expected to be negatively impacted. Biden's unprecedented and aggressive move to make vaccines mandatory for a considerable portion of the American society can highlight the gravity of the risk the U.S. economy is currently facing from the deadly contagion.
U.S. President Joe Biden has once again defended his controversial decision to withdraw from Afghanistan.
If you had told anybody that we were going to spend $300 million a day for 20 years to try to unite the country after we got bin Laden, after Al-Qaeda was wiped out there, can Al-Qaeda come back? Yeah, but guess what? It's already back other places. What's the strategy? Every place where Al-Qaeda is, we're going to invade and have troops stay there? people, 70% of American people, think it was time to get out of Afghanistan, spending all that money. But the flip of it is, they didn't like the way we got out. But it's hard to explain to anybody, how else could you get out?
Biden said U.S. forces had achieved their central mission when a special forces team killed al-Qaeda founder Osama bin Laden in 2011. He made the remarks in a visit to the site of one of the 9/11 plane crashes in Pennsylvania. All living former U.S. presidents, except Jimmy Carter and Donald Trump, attended formal events to mark the 20th anniversary of the attacks. Trump visited a police precinct in New York. He used the event to criticize Biden and describe the withdrawal from Afghanistan as horrible.
It's a horrible thing that took place. A horrible, horrible thing. It's an embarrassment. And the likes of which our country has never been embarrassed before. We've never had anything like this happen. It looked like we retreated. It looked like we gave up. Like they used the word surrender. And we didn't surrender. Our people didn't surrender. And our soldiers sure as hell didn't surrender.
We should have never gotten into that quicksand. Trillions of dollars, millions of lives if you look at both sides. But when you get out, you have to get out with honor, dignity, strength, and victory. We would have had victory.
The U.S. and its allies invaded Afghanistan in late 2001 and toppled the Taliban. Two decades on, the group stormed back to power after the U.S. military abruptly exited Afghanistan last month. During his presidency, Trump brokered a deal with the Taliban in February 2020 that would have seen all U.S. troops out by May 2021 in return for security guarantees from the group. But it was his successor, Biden, who carried out the withdrawal after moving the date back to August 31st and lifted all conditions.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Since the Cold War began, Washington has engaged in an endless series of interventions around the planet, from Chile to Guatemala, as well as in conflicts large and small, says Tom Engelhardt, writer, in an article titled, Imagine Spending $8 Trillion to Rebuild the Society Instead of Destroying One. Stay tuned for more. They weren't kidding when they called Afghanistan the graveyard of empires. Indeed, that cemetery has just taken another imperial body. And it wasn't pretty, was it? Not that anyone should be surprised. Even after 20 years of preparation, a burial never is. In fact, the shock and awfulness in Kabul and Washington over these last weeks shouldn't have been surprising, given U.S. history. After all, Americans were the ones who prepared the ground and dug the grave for the previous internment in that very cemetery. Count on this, though. The politicians of the great power that hasn't won a significant war since 1945 will agree on one thing, that the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex deserve yet more funding, no matter what else doesn't. When on February 15, 1989, the Red Army finally left Afghanistan, crossing the Friendship Bridge into Uzbekistan, Soviet Commander General Boris Gromov, the last man out, said, "That's it. Not one Soviet soldier or officer is behind my back." It was his way of saying so long farewell, good riddance to the endless war that the leader of the Soviet Union had by then taken to calling the bleeding wound. Yet, in his own strange fashion, that graveyard would come home with them. After all, they returned to a bankrupt land, sucked dry by that failed war against those American and Saudi-backed extremists. 2 years later, the Soviet Union would implode, leaving just one truly great power on planet Earth. Along with, of course, those very extremists Washington had built into a USSR destroying force. Only a decade later, in response to an air force manned by 19 mostly Saudi hijackers, dispatched by Osama bin Laden, a rich Saudi prince who had been part of anti-Soviet effort in Afghanistan, the world's sole superpower, would head directly for that graveyard. Despite the American experience in Vietnam during the previous century, the Afghan effort of 1980s was meant to give the USSR its own Vietnam. Key Bush administration officials were so sure of themselves that, as the New York Times recently reported, they wouldn't even consider letting the leaders of the Taliban negotiate a surrender once the invasion began. On September 11, 2001, in the ruins of the Pentagon, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld had already given an aide these instructions, referring not just to bin Laden, but Iraqi ruler Saddam Hussein. "Go massive, sweep it up, all up, things related or not." Now, he insisted, the United States is not inclined to negotiate surrenders. Allow a surrender and have everything grind to a disappointing halt? Not a chance. Not when the Afghan war was the beginning of what was to be an American triumph of global proportions. After all, the future invasion of Iraq and the domination of the oil-rich West Asia-North Africa region by the one and only power on the planet were already on the agenda. How could the leaders of such a confident land with a military funded at the levels the next most powerful countries combined couldn't match have imagined its own 2021 version of surrender? And yet once again, 20 years later, Afghanistan has quieted visibly and horrifyingly become a graveyard of empire, as well, of course, as a graveyard for Afghans. Perhaps it's only fitting that the Secretary of Defense, who refused the surrender of the enemy in 21, was recently buried in Arlington National Cemetery with full honors. In fact, the present Secretary of Defense and the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff both reportedly knelt before Mr. Rumsfeld's widow, Joyce, who was in a wheelchair, and presented her with a flag from her husband's coffin. Meanwhile, Joe Biden was the third president since George W. Bush and crew launched this country's forever wars to find himself floundering helplessly in that same graveyard of empires. If the Soviet example didn't come to mind, it should have, as Democrats and Republicans, President Biden and former President Trump, flailed at each other over their supposedly deep feelings for the poor Afghans being left behind. While this country withdrew its troops from Kabul airport in a land where rest in peace has long had no meaning. Here's the thing, though. Don't assume that Afghanistan is the only imperial graveyard around, or that the U.S. can simply withdraw, however ineptly, chaotically, and bloodily, leaving that country to history and the Taliban. Put another way, even though events in Kabul and its surroundings took over the mainstream news recently, the Soviet example should remind us that when it comes to empires, imperial graveyards are hardly restricted to Afghanistan. Since the Cold War began, Washington has engaged in an endless series of interventions around the planet, from Chile to Guatemala, as well as in conflicts large and small. Now, with Joe Biden having withdrawn from America's disastrous Afghan war, you might wonder whether it's all finally coming to an end, even if the U.S. still insists on maintaining 750 sizable military bases globally. Count on this, though. The politicians of the great power that hasn't won a significant war since 1945 will agree on one thing, that the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex deserve yet more funding, no matter what else doesn't. In truth, those institutions have been the major recipients of actual infrastructure spending over much of what might still be thought of as the American century. They have been the true winners in this society, along with the billionaires who, even in the midst of a grotesque pandemic, raked in profits in a historic fashion. In the process, those tycoons created possibly the largest inequality gap on the planet, one that could destabilize a democracy even if nothing else were going. The losers don't even get people started. Or think of it this way. Yes, in August 2021, it was Kabul, not Washington, D.C., that fell to the enemy. But the nation-building project in which this country has been involved over these last decades hasn't remained thousands of miles away. Only half notice here, it's been becoming home big time. You can't tell a lot about a country if you know where its politicians unanimously agree to invest taxpayer dollars. At this very moment, the U.S. is in a series of crises, none worse than the heat, fire, and flood season that's hit not just the mega drought-ridden West or inundated Tennessee or hurricane-hacked Louisiana or the tropical storm-tossed Northeast, but the whole country. Unbearable warmth, humidity, fires, smoke, storms, and power outages, that's America. As America's eternally losing generals come home from Kabul, what we actually had in mind was the one thing just about everyone in Washington seems to agree on: funding the military-industrial complex beyond their wildest dreams. Congress has recently spent months trying to pass a bill that would, over a number of years, invest an extra $550 billion in this country's badly tattered infrastructure, but never needs time like that to pass Pentagon and other national security budgets that for years now have added up to well over $1 trillion annually.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm your host, Muzaffar Haidar. Here in the studio today, we have with us Sayyid Mahdi and Sheikh Ali. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So we've discussed JCPOA, we've discussed how this deal was agreed to by Iran, but then how America was treacherous, they tore up the plan. And then the European nations also did not speak out against this atrocity. Now, the question today that I'd like to pose for both of you is this. Can Iran leave international negotiations completely? Like, just stop having these negotiations and depend only on domestic powers. Is such a strategy true and will it work in today's world? Sayyid Mahdi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is a, you know, there's multiple angles and variables here that can be taken into consideration. I'm just going to start off with a general statement, you know, and then slowly we'll go into details and go into more specific things so that the discussion is much more clearer. Of course, you know, in this kind of so-called global village that we live in, which we're going to, I think one of the things we should talk about is this global village, in the words of the leader of Islamic Revolution, Sayyid Ali Khamenei. If you guys remind me, what he says is specifically global village. But anyways, in the common man's term that everybody understands, right, that this global village is such that it's very difficult not to have interactions and relations with other countries. So that is a general statement that I'd like to put out there. And going into specifics, you know, I think I'll hand it over to Sheikh Ali so that one by one we'll go into specifics of what this question really entails.
Sheikh Ali?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, theoretically speaking, any country and any nation can choose to do that. But given the way the world is today, it doesn't make sense for any country to sideline itself and start to live in isolation. Now, there are two major aspects of this question. One is, can a country survive by taking an approach where they don't have any bilateral agreements with their neighboring countries and other regional countries and the countries of the world? The other side of it is, does it make sense for any country to do that, right? These are two potentially two different aspects. Mm-hmm. The answer to the first one is, well, theoretically, it's possible. The second prong of the question is, like, you know, does it make sense? It doesn't really make sense. When we look at the instructions of the leader of the Muslim Ummah, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei, he has been very clear that we are not against having relationships with other countries.
Mm-hmm.
But these relationships are supposed to be bilateral, at same footing, respecting other nation and other countries' dignity, while the model that the West continues to propagate and, you know, through actions it is enforcing on the world is the model of subjugation.
Mm-hmm.
It is not the model of cooperation. It is not the model of working together for common goals and mutual interests. Rather, the West and the imperialist and the block of arrogance, they are adamant that any country or any government or any nation that has to work with them has to be subjugated by the West. They have to listen and take instructions and take orders from the West. And this is where the real issue is. The crux of the matter is, when you look at the West Asian region, which is wrongly called Middle East, right?
Mm.
The policies of the Islamic Republic of Iran, according to the leader, are at 180 degrees from that of the policies of the block of arrogance led by America. So how can the two reconcile when you are completely, in every small little thing, you are completely against each other's position? How can you work with them? Now, when we talk about these international relations, unfortunately, one of the things that comes to people's mind is that, okay, international relations mean that we have to have good relationship with America and France and Britain and Germany. Well, guess what? It is not confined to that.
Yeah.
when we look at the countries in this region, we have over 150 countries that are ready and open to work with each other without arrogance, without you know, strong-arming the other party.
Mm-hmm.
All of these countries can work together. I think the solution is, and the nations are realizing it now, by the way, the solution is to sideline the United States of America as long as it continues to be that arrogant superpower, so to speak, which is trying to manipulate other nations and control other nations. They need to be sidelined. Rest of the countries, they can work together with each other. Just last point is about the Zionist regime, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes, you know, it comes up when the international relations are being discussed, relationships with the Zionist regime of Israel comes up. Well, the thing is, what our listeners need to realize, which again is a topic of its own, is that Israel is not a country. It is not a legitimate country. It is an occupation.
Mm-hmm.
And to work with occupation is not as if I'm just working with another country.
Yeah.
No, these are two different things. So Israel has to be definitely and completely, no matter what, doesn't matter how humble they become, doesn't matter how, you know, non-arrogant they become, there is no way that countries can work with the Zionist regime of Israel, primarily because of its illegal creation and inception. But when it comes to the other countries of the world, yes, we are open to bilateral working relationship with them, and it is the need of the hour, and I think Islamic Republic of Iran also looks at it like this. They have good relationships with the regional countries and the neighboring countries. There are trade agreements. There are political agreements, so on and so forth, and it will continue.
You know, I find it fascinating that you pointed out that the best way going forward is to sideline America, and the other nations are actually starting to understand this now.
Mm-hmm.
In the past, what America has itself tried to do is try to sideline Iran.
Yep. Yep.
But through this whole, you know, this whole, what do we call it, this entire kind of failed strategy of the West, it's actually backfired against them.
It definitely is. Why? Because the awareness has increased, right? Also, the other nations, they're seeing that despite all the threats, despite all the pressures, as America itself calls it to be the quote-unquote maximum pressure on Iran, the Islamic Republic has been able to survive. So it is a very clear message for other nations and other countries that we don't have to be bullied around by the United States of America and give up on our rights and our basic human necessities because America is bullying us, right?
Yeah.
It's a very clear message, and they're seeing it more and more. On the other hand, America itself is drowning, not just economically. When we talk about these types of things, you know, all people can think of is like economic and finance. No.
Mm-hmm.
Even their political system, as the leader has said, it's drowning, right?
Mm-hmm.
Their social fabric is completely disturbed. Their society is falling apart.
Yeah.
So America is losing its ground, and other nations, other governments are closely watching it.
They are. Sid Mathy. So this phenomenon is very interesting, the way that America tried to sideline Iran and the way that the West tried to target Iran. And, you know, throughout the years, we saw that America invaded Iraq, having claimed that they have weapons of mass destruction. They had invaded Afghanistan. And then they started to point the finger at Iran and say that Iran is dangerous. Iran is going to, you know, attack other countries. They're a maniac nation. We had the famous iconography that it's become of Benjamin Netanyahu holding up that picture of a cartoon bomb and saying that we only have a little bit of time left. And now, after all these years have passed and people have seen the true colors of both Iran and America and the Zionists, it's whenever they call out for war with Iran or they try to target Iran in any way, it seems like that the other countries like China and India and Russia and all the other countries in the world sort of just roll their eyes, like, ugh, it's America again.
Mm-hmm.
So what are your thoughts on this?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yeah, it's interesting, right, that how the dynamics on a global level have changed so radically. Because the United States of America, the government in the past was a government that at least superficially it showed a lot of power, a lot of, in Arabic we call it rob, but you can say a lot of power, a lot of bullying, I guess it's really what it comes down to. And a lot of countries in the world were scared of the United States of America. They were scared of financial sanctions. They were scared of running into a war with the United States of America, and all these negative repercussions that in the past were seen, which will occur if you oppose the United States of America, right? Mm-hmm. This is what it used to be like. Now it's very interesting. Like you said, they have not been able to contain Iran. They have not been able to contain Russia. They have not been able to contain China. They haven't even been able to contain Venezuela, which is, in their own words, in their own backyard, let alone come to the other side of the world and try to contain Syria and Bashar al-Assad, or try to contain Iraq, or, you know, and it's funny.
They can't even contain their own people.
Exactly. Thank you. That's a very beautiful point right there. It hadn't crossed my mind. They can't even contain their own people anymore. So they've totally lost control of the game, you know. And on one side is quite funny. On the other side is quite unfortunate, because it seems like, what are we going to do, right? We used to say that, what are we going to do when Trump leaves office? A lot of the comedians on United States television, on American television shows, that's what they would say. They said that, man, we had a lot of jokes when Donald Trump was in the office. So what are we going to do now that America has fallen? You know, one of the things that I wanted to bring up, which Sheikh Ali talked about, was, yeah, we're open, or the Islamic Republic and the Islamic Revolution is open to negotiating, talking, having a dialogue, having relations, having interactions with everybody across the world, right? But what must be kept in mind is, how does a person who is judging the global arena expect a nation such as the Islamic Republic to enter into interactions and relations and discourse with another nation, the United States of America, who has proclaimed itself to be the open enemy of the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that doesn't make any sense. And so you see a lot of things on the ground since the inception of the Islamic Revolution, 40 years of sanctions against the Islamic Republic, 40 years of warmongering, 40 years of building bases all around this country, whether it's, and they're all illegal bases, by the way, whether mm-hmm. it's Iraq, Afghanistan, these, you know, former Soviet states, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and these guys, Azerbaijan, Syria.
Just a point there. America claims, and most of the presidents, they would claim that they're not enemies of the Iranian people, but right. rather the American system, the Iranian government. So how would you counter such a claim?
Yeah, of course. So sanctions are not aimed at a specific government, right? Sanctions are aimed, they end up hurting the people. So, for example, one of the most common things is medical supplies. There's a huge sanctions that the United States of America has imposed on the Islamic Republic, which deals with medical supplies. So these mm-hmm. medical supplies, it doesn't affect the government, right, per se. It affects the common people. It affects, and not just the common people that are healthy, it affects the common people that are sick, that are ailing, that need medical aid. And this is just one of the things, right, that mm-hmm. that it is. So this is a big kind of a it is a lie, it is a facade that, no, we love the Iranian people, but we're going to sanction the country so that the people are the one who are going to die, right? I don't know, Sheikh Ali, if you want to bring in a point here, I think.
I think you said it all. They're trying to portray as if they are sanctioning the government institutes and government personalities and, you know, the government apparatus, which is a lie. While they are targeting the government and the system, at the same time, majority of these sanctions are impacting the average Iranian's life, mm-hmm. right? So when there's inflation, an average Iranian gets affected. When there are no medications that are needed by those people who are suffering from a disease, Iranian people, they end up suffering.
Yeah.
When they target, for instance, universities, it's the Iranian students who are suffering, right? They go after the religious institutions, you know, it's a religious community living in Iran, which it's a predominantly a religious country. They are the ones who are suffering. So it's a lie. Basically, what they're trying to do is they're trying to get the people to rise up against their system. The message that Iran is giving to Iranian nation is that you need to stand up and overthrow this government, because we couldn't do it even after enforcing an 8-year-long war. We couldn't do it. We couldn't fight these people overseas, even in Syria and Iraq. So now we're really banking on the average Iranians to stand up against their own system, overthrow the government, and overthrow the Islamic system, which is a dream, mm-hmm. right? This Islamic system had 98% of people, voting to bring in the Islamic system, because, like I said, Iran is a predominantly religious country. It's a dream that they're seeing, and now they're, through these sanctions, they're making the average Iranian desperate to stand against the system, which has not happened. We have seen it, alhamdulillah, except for a few infiltrations that America has done by using its, petrodollars and stuff. There was no mainstream movement against the Islamic system in the last 40 years.
Yeah.
This is amazing, right? Despite all this pressure, and despite people knowing that it's the Islamic system because of which America is against us, they're still not standing up against the Islamic system and Islamic system of governance. This speaks a lot about the people of Iran. And alhamdulillah, it's going to stay this way. This is what they're trying to do, basically. This is why they are targeting Iran.
That's all we have time for today. From myself, from Sayyid Mahdi, and from Sheikh Ali, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. This is Viewpoints, coming to you from IRIB English Radio.
You're the reason my life's worth living. You're the reason I'm alive. I'd be lost without you. You're the reason that I strive. You're my destiny. You're my revenue. You're the reason that I breathe. You are all.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
The American presence in war-ravaged Afghanistan, often described as a graveyard of empires, not only failed to wipe out the threat of terrorism, but actually fanned its flames. We now present you an article written by Sayyid Zafar Mahdi, a Tehran-based journalist, editor and blogger with over 12 years of experience, who has reported extensively from Kashmir, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan and Iran for leading publications worldwide. The piece is titled, How Post-9/11 US War on Terror Spawned Terrorism. Thank you. nasty, brutish and long-drawn-out American war on terrorism that began in the wake of the suspicious 9/11 attacks 20 years ago has only spawned more terrorism and more insecurity. The military invasion of Afghanistan started with the Pentagon carpet-bombing the landlocked country with B-52 heavy bombers and gunships. The disastrously misguided and disproportionate response to the cataclysmic events of 9/11 found expression in the so-called Global War on Terror, which has since consumed tens of thousands of lives from Afghanistan to Iraq and elsewhere. The nasty, brutish and long-drawn-out war on terror has only spawned more terrorism, despite successive regimes in Washington and their Western allies trying to conceal the truth. 20 years on, the war-ravaged country again finds itself at a crossroads. The Taliban fighters are back in power, Al-Qaeda is still around and thriving, while Daesh terrorist group has quietly and stunningly made its way from Iraq and Syria to Afghanistan. That's how America's ominous presence breeds terrorism rather than annihilating it. In the aftermath of the suspicious 9/11 attacks, Americans vowed to crush every terrorist group within their reach, including Al-Qaeda. Former U.S. President George W. Bush famously declared on 20th of September 2001, "The U.S. war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but does not end there." The imprudence was clearly evident. The invasion of Afghanistan less than a month after four hijacked American planes crashed into landmark buildings in New York and Washington on 11th of September 2001, killing 2,977 people, was reckless, poorly planned and shoddily executed. As the U.S. dispatched long-range B-52, Stratofortress strategic bombers, AC-130 Spectre gunships, and MQ-9 Reaper drones to flatten the Tora Bora cave complex in eastern Afghanistan, where Osama bin Laden was reported to be hiding, Barbara Lee was the only U.S. congresswoman to vote against authorizing what was to turn out to be America's longest war in history. Barbara Lee was labeled a traitor by those who championed the military invasion that incurred an astronomically high cost, with innocent Afghan civilians bearing the brunt. The mindless war found support among both U.S. Republicans and Democrats as they rallied behind George W. Bush and his hawkish Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to exact the revenge. The bombing campaign was launched on 7th of October 2001 on the pretext of decimating the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and capturing the 9/11 mastermind Osama bin Laden, the former CIA ally and the founder of Al-Qaeda, who was apparently hosted by the Taliban. The core objective of the three-week bombing campaign, dubbed Operation Enduring Freedom, was achieved in less than 3 months. But the Americans decided against quitting Afghanistan. There was certainly more to it than that, beyond the bluff and bluster of fighting terrorism. If eliminating Al-Qaeda and the Taliban or taking out Osama bin Laden were prime objectives of the military invasion, the U.S.-led Allied troops would have called it quits long ago. But the aim was to occupy Afghanistan to make the mineral-rich country strategically located between Central and South Asia subservient to the West. Clear from the way George W. Bush and Donald Rumsfeld snubbed the Taliban's offer of a truce to avoid confrontation. Before the bombardment began, the group offered to hand over Osama bin Laden to a third country for trial and even agreed to lay down arms and recognize the government in Kabul led by Hamid Karzai. The offers were spurned, leading to a 20-year military adventure that ended in the worst U.S. military and strategic debacle. The American public, who initially supported the idea of military action against the perpetrators of the 9/11 attacks, eventually became its fierce opponents, as the futile war dragged on for years, metamorphosing into the worst U.S. foreign policy disaster. For 20 years, the war in Afghanistan remained an enigma for the successive U.S. administrations, from George W. Bush to Joe Biden. After invading the country and destroying it beyond recognition, George W. Bush abandoned Afghanistan and launched another costly military adventure in neighboring Iraq in 2003. Both experiments proved counterproductive. His successor, Barack Obama, refocused on Afghanistan, killing bin Laden 10 years after the suspicious 9/11 attacks, not in the mountains of Afghanistan, but in the Pakistani city of Abbottabad, a short jog from military base. Barack Obama then began the drawdown, but stopped short of complete withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan. Years later, his successor Donald Trump signed a deal with the Taliban, pledging to withdraw American occupying forces from Afghanistan. It was the same militant group his fellow Republican president George W. Bush once vowed to decimate. Donald Trump was consigned to the dustbin of history before he could execute the plan. It was his successor Joe Biden, his political rival, who finally pulled the plug on America's longest war. The disastrous war ended in August of 2021, the way it started in October of 2001, in a violent, disorderly, shambolic, reckless fashion. Amidst the chaotic evacuation of Kabul's Hamid Karzai International Airport, a Daesh suicide bomber blew himself up, killing more than 200 people, including 13 U.S. service members. The ghastly incident underscored not only the vulnerability of ordinary Afghans, but also the U.S. failure to eliminate the threat of terrorism in Afghanistan. More importantly, it also blew the lid off the sinister interventionism and hegemonic ambitions of the U.S. military-industrial complex in foreign lands, from Somalia to Afghanistan. As reporters later revealed, many of those killed at the Kabul airport didn't fall to suicide bombings, but to indiscriminate firefight by American occupation forces. More civilians were to perish hours later in the U.S. drone strike, including Afghan women and children. So, as some pundits would argue, 20 years after the doomed U.S. military mission began in Afghanistan, Osama bin Laden has won the war posthumously. The American presence in the war-ravaged country, often described as the graveyard of empires, not only failed to wipe out the threat of terrorism, but it actually fanned its flames.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.